It's the Barry Pod on 99.3 thevine.com.
This is the Barry Pod, and this episode recorded on November 14th, 2023. This time, my guest in the pod is Larry Kamer. Larry, welcome.
Nice to be back.
It's great to have you. Question number one, Larry Kamer is a name that gets bandied about here and there. We see your name pop up in news stories once in a while. You are a podcaster, a man of many talents. What is it exactly that you do?
So I am in the strategic communications business. So that means that I, my primary focus is consulting with clients on communication plans, marketing, crisis communications, dealing with, you know, politics and issues. And that ranges from, you know, companies, real estate developers, wineries. I used to have a much more national and even international focus. But about 10 years ago when we moved up here, really brought it home. There's plenty of interesting work here in the Napa Valley and in the Bay Area generally. So that's what I do. So that's one thing. I also teach I'm an adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco, where I've been for about 12 years. And I teach graduate students in leadership communications, and I teach a course in crisis communications. I also teach at the at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, where they have a really great information security officer program. So we work with them on data security, cyber attacks, and that sort of thing, and the crisis management aspect of that. And then, as you and I have talked about, I'm a co-founder of Highway 29 Media here in Napa, which is, you know, started as an attempt to save the Onfield Sun and the Calistoga Tribune. And now, you know, we have aspirations to be a more sustainable, broad-reaching kind of media organization. Mm-hmm.
Why is a paper like the Yountville Sun worth saving?
Because what happens is, in communities like Yountville, when the local paper disappears, a lot of the glue that holds the community together goes away. And you see things like, creates more room for disinformation. So instead of getting your news from the Yountville Sun, you're going to see more people getting their news from Twitter or Nextdoor or... And, you know, no knock on those things, but they are not vetted like, you know, like news, like traditional news is. It's a rallying cry. Advertisers, readers, people want to talk about it in the letters to the editor. So that's the main reason is, you know, you just become a lesser place if you don't have a good local news source, whether it's a print paper or an online source. And when you look at that at a bigger level, oversight of government decreases, oversight of business decreases, polarization increases as people look at more social media, you know, for their sources of information. So it's just really important. And even in a small town like Yountville or Calistoga, it matters.
The question of trust is foremost in my mind a lot of times around media issues, government issues, just about everything. Just today, we're recording this on the 14th of November, and just today we have the story in the news about the Supreme Court having instituted a code of ethics, which is toothless and doesn't seem to really have any value, but they're trying to address the fact that for the first time in my lifetime, we have all these questions about what are these people doing? How are they coming to the conclusions and the decisions they're making? They're being influenced like a regular member of the House of Representatives or something? Really? Is that what's been going on all this time?
Yeah.
I don't know if I have any trust left to be shaken at this point, and I think most Americans feel that way.
Yeah.
The areas you're working in, especially when you get into the crisis communication, corporate or company communication, that's got to be one of the biggest challenges you're dealing with, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, every institution, whether it's a nonprofit or a company, a university, a religious institution, has, a real or metaphorical kind of license to operate, right? They are given permission to do what they do by regulators, legislators, customers, neighbors. And trust is one of those things that smart organizations invest in, and they, you know, put it in the bank because they know they're going to have to withdraw it in large quantities, you know, whenever a crisis happens. You know, and I always look at these things as when something really bad happens, do you get the benefit of the doubt? Do people say, yeah, that's terrible, but I know those people, and I don't think they're the kind of people who would do that sort of thing. That's so critical, that benefit of the doubt. And we see it all the time where organizations that, you know, not to pick on anybody, but, you know, Catholic Church, for example, which we do some work with, you know, there are true believers within that community, but an awful lot of people outside of that community instantly judge them because of what they think they know. And that's, you know, that's the question of reputation. That, you know, Lincoln said, you know, if the reality is the tree, reputation is the shadow. It's what we think we know about an organization or a person, whether we have personal experience with them or not. And so in our best days, when we do our work well, we're helping people maintain trust and build reputation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good luck.
Well, let's just say it's a good time to be in the it's a good time to be in the bad news business.
Yeah. Let's talk about something that I've enjoyed talking with you about many times in the past when you would join me for election coverage back
right.
when we were on KVON AM side, and maybe we'll do that in the future here on the Vine.
You got my number, man.
Local politics seems to be changing. And what may have been, I don't know, the straw that broke the camel's back, to be cliche, possibly was this vineyard development project called La Colline. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, something that had been apparently on the track and was moving toward being approved has been completely derailed. And I'm sure there are lawsuits coming, and we'll be dealing with this for a long time. What happened there that's different from in the past? Well, we have a different composition on the Board of Supervisors.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all there is to it? Is it just a question of some different people with different views of what's right for Napa County? Or is there a larger movement here that's going to affect other proposals for vineyard development?
There's a lot to take apart there. I think... Listen, elected officials, you know, take the steps that they take because they think they've got cover and support for doing it. And what's interesting to me is that you have more and more of them openly questioning, you know, what we've long considered the kind of golden goose here. And which, when you look at the numbers, you know, really is massively important to our economy, that and tourism. La Colline, what's interesting to me is it's smaller than so many of the other much more controversial developments. But I think you have some folks on that board who are kind of flexing their muscles a little bit and who aren't afraid, you know, to call BS on things they think they need to call BS on. Now, on the other side of things, you know, I can see how... you know, growers and wineries, you know, you hear a lot from them about how they feel that the decisions are made on emotion and not on science. You know, you hear them say that the county is difficult to deal with because they're all over the place in terms of what do they really regulate? What are they really going to focus on? And so, I mean, the best thing I can say is you have a really dynamic situation right now, much more dynamic. And you have elections coming up that could, you know, you could have a 5-member all-female Board of Supervisors when we wake up after the next election under some circumstances. And that'd be a big shift.
Yeah, and not just all-female, but maybe all of a similar mind about some of these issues where, for lack of a more elegant way to put it, environmentalism becoming more the center rather than a consideration on the side.
Yeah, and I think knowing most of those members, and now getting to know some of the candidates, you know, who are running. I'm not sure they would want to put themselves in a box and say, I'm a reliable anti-growth vote or a reliable environmental vote. But as you say, they're certainly not afraid to listen to constituents who feel very strongly, you know, in those aspects of the argument. You know, when they talk about things like oak woodland preservation, watershed preservation, erosion, fire safety, there's a lot of questions being raised that haven't in the past. Or at least being raised more sharply, you know, because they've always been in the background. There's always been a constituency for that consideration in this community. But yeah, I think you're right. I think we're seeing a pretty interesting political rumbling going on.
Yeah. And looking in the rearview mirror, the Walt Ranch proposal, which was the lightning rod, the center of all the worry about tree removal and all the other things you just mentioned, very surprisingly took this turn and has become land trust property and so on. Did that happen because the Halls saw the handwriting on the wall and they were going to be in for a long, expensive fight because of the change of mood?
You know, I can't speak for them. I don't know them personally. I'm not involved in that project, but like you, you know, have watched it from the outside. And I feel like it took a lot out of them, for sure, you know, financially, emotionally, time-wise, distraction-wise. And you have to be a very special kind of person to want to see through a development project like that. You know, I have a lot of developer friends and clients, and I can't do that. I mean, I couldn't be in that business because you have to have an iron stomach, you have to have resources, you have to have patience, and you have to put up with a lot of BS, you know, over a long period of time. Now, on the flip side, some of them have incredible vision. You know, they think of things you and I would never think about. You know, they're not all evil people as much as they get characterized that way. But you have to have stick-to-itiveness. And even the most persistent, self-confident, even well-heeled people, there are limitations.
For sure. Larry Kamer, our guest in the Berry Pod, and so many, 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 many things we can talk about. I want to shift focus from local to the big picture, the national picture right now. We thought things were topsy-turvy in 2016 when Donald Trump first ran, and the results of that election changed everybody's perception of this country and what was our future and so on. We're looking at almost 8 years since that, and things are, in many ways, still just as disrupted and fractious and hard to understand as they were.
Worse.
Yeah. We see this, you know, group of, what, 8 Republicans in the House that are dictating what happens in a body of 435 people. We have inability to elect a speaker. We have spending proposals that are going nowhere and maybe another government shutdown and just, like, this dysfunction. You know, at some point, either the car completely breaks down and you can't move it at all, and you call in a tow truck, or somebody fixes the car. What, in your mind, out of that mess of things I just said, is any sort of a beacon, some kind of a hopeful thought about us getting back on track? I started talking about trust. We have that issue. We have broken politics where we can't seem to get anything done. We have people who just want to say no, but they don't have any alternative proposals.
Wow. You know, so you take your tiny little crumbs of optimism where you can. So I woke up this morning reading that the new Speaker of the House may well do a deal with the Democrats to keep the government open. That makes total sense. You know, it's only in this crazy world of politics where that could cost you your job. You know, as Kevin McCarthy or Paul Ryan or John Boehner or, you know, any of these other predecessors, you know, would tell you. What I always find so interesting, and I'll reveal a little partisan, you know, bias here, is Nancy Pelosi had the exact same margins, you know, when she was Speaker, and you didn't really see any of this stuff. You know, it's a difference between somebody who really knows how to run a caucus and somebody who is afraid, I think, of their own members. I think, you know, as cheesy as it is, I do have trust in the voters. I do feel like when this question comes up at the national presidential level, there is an awful lot of bedwetting and fretting. And frankly, I, you know, one of the things that's happening with this polarization of news that we were talking about earlier is you have more and more people actually avoiding the news entirely, and a significant number of people looking to news sources outside of the United States, like the BBC, which is very popular in the U.S. all of a sudden. So I'm just as guilty of it. There are days when I just don't want, you know, if I turn on the news sources that I usually go to, it's going to be all Trump, all Middle East, all Ukraine. These are important issues, but I got to draw the line, you know, at some point and say I know what I'm gonna be in for here. I'm just not gonna do it. I'm gonna listen to music or do something else.
Radio is always a good option.
Radio is a great option. You should see all the radio stations I have on my iPhone.
There used to be, I think back to, you know, having always followed politics in the news from childhood, kind of precocious, and I would sit next to my dad on the couch and watch Walter Cronkite.
Right.
And I was very aware of what was happening in Vietnam, and I remember being maybe 10 years old worrying that I was going to get drafted someday. You know, I missed that by just a couple of years.
You and I are probably the same age, because I actually got a draft number.
Yeah.
But then they ended the draft mercifully right after that.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, being aware of things for all that period of time, going through, you know, Watergate, which I feel like scarred me psychically, all that sense of trust in my American patriotism and like, oh, my gosh, the leader of the country is a crook.
Right.
Right. That was bad. Vietnam, of course, and all the outcome of that. And you try to rebuild that, and it's not easy, because you've got this cynicism that's still inside you. Mm. And I worry about young people today, what they're learning about how, you know, how coarse politics has become, how untrustable these people are, untrustworthy in so many different ways. You know, how do we recover that? Some of the institutions that used to support feeling good, the church, scouting, all these other things have been tarnished in these same ways. Is there such a thing as rediscovering a national sense of purpose? Because I feel that has been lacking for a very long time.
Yeah, and I think you see glimmers of it in younger generations. You know, I'm fortunate in that I'm in a classroom every week, you know, with people in their 20s. You know, their grad students are a little older. They have a little bit of worldly experience. You know, I've got two kids in their 30s and now a grandkid, you know. And I, you know, it's very easy to joke about the millennials and the Gen Xers and, you know, they're this, they're that. But that's exactly what our parents said about us. And it's probably the exact same thing their parents said about them, you know, kids these days. I think that generation of people, you know, they are rightfully cynical of our generation for, you know, all the challenges and screw-ups that we're leaving them with. But I also feel, I also get a sense that they want to find a better life. They want to live purposeful lives. They want to make a difference in the world. And it may be expressed in ways that we don't understand in social media. And, you know, my son runs a podcast, you know, which was not really a career option for me when I was, you know, when I was in my 30s. So I really do feel like there is a lot of that gives you some hope. I also feel like the big gap is we have got to find ways for intergenerational communication and contact. The generation gap, you remember that, right? Don't trust anyone over 30. I try and talk to my kids and my students about how In 1968, in this country, it was worse than it is now. It's bad now, but it was really worse. I mean, you would just look at people by the way they looked on the street and judge them if they were, you know, long-haired or crew-cut or black or white or... And it was worse. And you and I were young, but we were conscious, you know, in that time. So we've seen worse, and we've seen it get better. And it only gets better generationally, you know, when we get out of the way, folks like you and me, get out of the way and let them run the show. So I'm not cynical all the time. I'm depressed a lot because I don't know how much more Trump news I can take. And the guy's not even president. But there I'm revealing a partisan bias. So I think there is reason for hope, but like any other kind of change, it is long in the making. It's going to be long in the making.
I do have to agree with you that when you spend some time around younger people, it does help the cynicism and the depression. I have exactly the same attitude you have about these stereotypes about millennials and Gen X or whatever.
Right.
Totally wrong. People who say those things are
well,
not.
Well, some of it's right.
Well, yeah,
but
those people are not spending much time with those young people.
Yeah, and like I said, if you take the long view, and you know, I remember what our parents said about us, and as I said, probably what their parents, you know, my parents are first generation, right? So I'm sure their parents, coming from the old country, looked at them as just cosseted and spoiled, and you know, so every generation makes harsh judgments about the one that comes after. But I agree with you. I think if you spend time and look at what people are saying and writing and thinking. I don't agree with all of it. A lot of it is very disagreeable, but it's not like they're waiting for us to give them a better life. They're trying to find it themselves.
Yeah. Since it came up, I wasn't going to plan to talk about this necessarily, but in that younger generation demographic, we're seeing this very vivid reaction to the conflict between Israel and Hamas in a way that I don't think we've ever seen in this country before. And some people like to say, oh, it's those liberal college campuses and blah, blah, blah. It's woke culture, blah, blah, blah. How do you grasp what's happening with this? What's your take on all that?
Well, you know, I've been involved in causes. I've been to Israel. I've been involved in I'm Jewish. I've been involved in a lot of Jewish community stuff. And I think a couple of things are true. And this is the hard part about this debate, is because many things are true at the same time, and a lot of them are in conflict. You know, it's very troubling to me to see people talk about, you know, get rid of Israel from the river to the sea, you know, that kind of stuff. On the other hand, you have a government in Israel that I think is completely sold out its people. I think they're focused on the wrong things. I think Netanyahu, somebody said Netanyahu is not just the worst leader in modern history, but maybe the worst Jewish leader ever. And I'm very critical of him. But I still think, you know, the cause of a homeland is a noble cause. Do I think what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza, the oppression of the Palestinians, is horrible? Yeah, it's horrible. We talk about the occupation of Gaza. Well, who's been occupying Gaza? It's been Hamas, right? So that's complicated. Has Israel waged this battle very, very aggressively? Should they be listening to people like Biden who say, I'm your friend, I love you, but you gotta dial it back? Yeah. So how can all these things be true at the same time? I think certain things are just base and evil, and you have to call them out. Anti-Semitism is base and evil, and you have to call it out. And there's a lot of that going around. What Hamas did was just unthinkably bad. You have to call it out. Should kids be, you know, killed in acts of war? Absolutely not. But you know, if we're going to be consistent, then we should be marching on the street against Assad and what he's doing in Syria, right? Exactly the same things that people are complaining about. So what's hard, and this is hard in the early days of war, the fog of war, is people jump to conclusions, they think they know, and then history tells us what really happened. And I feel like we have to just keep an open mind to what history is going to tell us about all this. So yeah, it's disturbing. It's disturbing to see how quickly, at least in my opinion, we go from anti-government to anti-Israel to anti-Zionism to anti-Jewish. Mm-hmm. That's really disturbing. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have to call it out and fight it. And it's not like we haven't been here before.
Yeah. So while we're on international affairs, one of the craziest things in my mind to try and understand is how there can be so many people who don't seem to have any historical perspective on the United States and Russia, or formerly the Soviet Union. These people, and some of them in prominent positions running for president, I can think of a couple right off the top of my head, who seem to be on Putin's side all the time, and that Ukraine is illegitimate, and give them the land that they've taken, they deserve it, they speak Russian there. These ridiculous concepts to me that don't take any historical context into consideration. How did we get there? And the follow-up question is, you really get to the point where you feel like some of these people are on the payroll. They have to be on the payroll.
They're at least useful idiots.
Yeah, useful idiots, or right. They're benefiting directly from spouting the propaganda of Russia right now.
Yeah. Well, again, going back to when you and I were younger, the most blindly, virulently anti-communists were Republicans. You know, Nixon, McCarthy. You know, there was nothing good that came from the Soviet Union or communist China. They were a reliable punching bag, boogeyman enemy. And then when you see some of the folks you're talking about saying, you know, well, maybe Putin's not wrong here, you know, or maybe we could just make this go away if we give Putin what he wants. There's a big part of me that says this underscores the power, the animating power in that wing of the Republican Party of just owning the libs. This idea that you're just going to say things because it's going to upset, you think it's going to upset a group of people you really don't like. Whether it makes sense or not, whether it's consistent or not. And so I think there's a big, I don't know what else can explain it other than, as you say, maybe some folks are seeing some economic, some status advantage of being in with that crowd. Mm-hmm. Pardon me. But, and we are seeing plenty of useful idiots, you know, in the political discussion now. But
And there's also this factor that I don't think really ever existed before in my mind. We're spending a lot of time being nostalgic here, I guess, for the better times. But the idea that if Larry Kamer says yes and I'm saying no, and I don't care what the issue is, I don't care what it's about, who's involved, but if the GOP likes it, I don't, and vice versa.
Right.
We've never been that way in the past. There were always reasonable people who would say, let's look at the facts here, and then I'll decide whether they were Democrats or Republicans or independents or whatever they were.
Right.
That's so toxic. That is not sustainable, is it?
No. And I think, you know, this is the direct extension of this lack of trust, where we have moved from disagree to despise and destroy. You know, it's like, you know, I've worked in politics a long, long time, and I've worked in two-party politics where, you know, you have it out with the people you disagree with, but you can always go have a conversation with them or have a beer with them or run into them in the grocery store on the weekend, and you're just talking like two human beings. I do feel like that time is, you know, it's definitely on the way out, and it's definitely suffering. And I do think it's going to come back. I think it has to if we want a country, you know. But it's going to be hard to watch for a while. And as I said a second ago, you have to call it out. And the other thing is, I think you have to check yourself when you are becoming part of that. You know, I watch, I like to, there's a host on MSNBC, Nicole Wallace, who I like a lot. She's a Republican. She went to my alma mater. You know, there's a lot about her that I like. I like, you know, where she comes from. But every single time she comes on the air, she will say, Trump is the, you know, four-time indicted, or, you know, twice impeached, disgraced, rapist, blah, 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 blah. I don't need to hear that every single time. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, you can get caught up in that kind of stuff too and just say, and that's why I say maybe sometimes just turn that stuff off and listen to some classical music.
Yeah.
You know, and clean your brain out.
A lot of that's ratings driven and playing the hits, as we would say in, in the music business. And that's what that viewer wants to hear. So you got to make sure you say it every time. And that happens on both sides. I don't know if you ever listened to any of the Bulwark folks.
I love it. I love the Bulwark.
I'm big into the Bulwark.
Well, and one of them, Tim Miller, who has been who was a guest on one of my shows and who I used to work with. He and I used to work at the same firm.
One of my favorite people right now.
Yeah, he's great. And what's interesting about Tim is his own personal journey. You know, when I knew him, when I worked with him 10 years ago, you know, very Republican, very conservative, a guy who had a really kind of unique voice as a gay man, but who was very committed to kind of mainstream Republican causes. And if you read his book, and if you listen to him or watch any of his gazillion media platforms, this guy's gone through a real journey.
Yeah.
And unlike many of us, he's done it kind of out in the open and chronicled it, and it's very personal. But it, to me, it says so much about what's going on in politics.
And people like Tim Miller, Charlie Sykes, the Bulwark founder, one of them, what you just said is really relevant, that going through a journey of examining, thinking, not just knee-jerk, I'm on this side. I'm always on this side. But thinking about, is this the side I want to be on, on this issue, that issue, this person, and realizing when you become part of something that isn't positive anymore.
Well, it's like, you know, it's like Reagan said, you know, when he became a Republican, he said, you know, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, it left me.
Exactly.
And I think that that is very true with a lot of people who, you know, are mainstream, traditional, kind of low tax, low government, Republicans, conservative, traditionally conservative Republicans, who just don't feel like they have a place anymore. And I feel for them. I've never been, you know, of that ideology, but I've certainly worked with, you know, lots of them. They're a big part of my life, clients, friends. And yeah, that's got to be really hard for something that you believed in your whole life. And all of a sudden it's, you know, people, you look around and people think it's just worthless.
Yeah, yeah. It can happen on in any political position. You suddenly discover you are allied with someone you don't trust, don't like, don't believe in, think they're cheating you somehow to earn your it's problematic. And
right.
You got to be aware of what your core is, what your set of personal beliefs are before you decide who you're going to follow.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Last question. We've gone local politics, international affairs,
We're going galactic now. We're going to go to Space Force.
On the planet Zorgon. My last question is about this presidential election that's now 1 year away.
Right.
What we hear on that media that constantly repeating the same themes is there are no other choices. It's going to be Trump and Biden. Nobody's happy with it. Nobody wants these two guys to be on the top of the ticket, but that's what's going to happen. Just get used to it. It's a year to go. That's a long way, especially for people in their upper 70s and 80 plus, right, to make it through to that.
People much older than you and me.
Much, much older and you know, not fit and healthy like us. So do you think this is truly inevitable? What do you think, who will we be voting for or against in November a year from now?
Well, odds are it's those two. But that doesn't, the thing that I love about watching pundits and politics is, you know, every time I watch them, I remind myself, these people really don't know what's going to happen. None of us does. None of us can predict the future. So it's all various forms of educated or entertaining speculation. So are the odds are it's Biden and Trump? Yeah. And if the American people are forced to make that choice, you know, they're not going to like it, but they're going to make that choice. Now, there's a couple of other things that could happen. You know, Joe Biden is I think, underrated for what a smart, operator he really is. He could wake up one day and say, you know, I've had it. I don't need to prove anything to anybody. I'm out. I don't need to run again. I don't need this. You know, I'm going to enjoy my golden years with my how many grandkids he's got. And I don't eliminate that possibility at all. So, you know, that keeps it interesting, yeah. You know, for me. But I also feel like, you know, it may, people say nobody, you know, you say nobody wants these two. Well, that's not quite true. A lot of people want these two. A lot of people are unhappy about that these are the two I have to choose from. But what are they really doing about it? You know, are these folks who are getting on the phones and organizing and sending money to various causes? But that's you know, politics is very much a spectator sport in our country.
Now, I said last question, but I have to follow up with one more. It's not been exactly subtle what Gavin Newsom's done in the last year or so, engaging with Ron DeSantis and
Xi Jinping.
Yeah,
right.
I'm going to argue about social issues in Florida and other. You know, why would you do that if you're only concerned about California? If Joe Biden wakes up one day and says, I don't need to do this anymore, is that the logical outcome, Gavin Newsom as the candidate?
Well, I mean, here we are talking about him as kind of the gentleman in waiting. I don't think that's by accident, and I don't think that would be such a terrible thing. I'm kind of a fan of his myself. I think he may scratch an itch that a lot of people have for somebody younger, somebody who knows how to win, raise money, and not, you know, take the fight to the other side. But, you know, he's never run. He is testing it out being a national figure. And I would say that's going a lot better for him than it is for, say, Ron DeSantis right now. There's a study in contrast about how do you run a kind of shadow campaign. Ron DeSantis' case, it's not a shadow campaign. But, you know, what an unbelievable fall from a guy who was flying high after his last reelection. So, yeah, I mean, here we are talking about Newsom. We'll be seeing a lot of him this week at AIPAC. You know, he's figured out a way to be in the conversation, and that's not easy to do. And I think that will come to benefit him, whether Biden decides not to run or whether we're talking about 4 years from now.
I had a very staunch and astute Republican, rock-ribbed Republican, as we used to say.
Rock-ribbed.
Maybe a year and a half ago, something Trump did, I can't remember what it was, and her reaction was, it's time for him just to get out of the way and let DeSantis go because he's the guy. And at the moment, I thought, yeah, you're probably right. He does look like he's the guy. And you talk about screwing the pooch. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
As somebody who works with causes and issues and candidates, it must be quite entertaining to watch somebody unable to grasp what needs to happen next.
Well, you just watch him, and he just seems like, I mean, I always say like should never be underestimated in politics. Like counts for a lot.
Oh, yeah.
If you get if people like you, and I don't mean you do things to make everybody like you, but I think, you know, if you seem to care about people, engage with them, are happy to be with them, don't mind spending the 20 hours a day you got to spend to be a public figure. He's just not that. He just looks like he's in pain, he would rather be having a root canal, you know, than be out campaigning. He says dumb things. He's awkward. His politics, I think, are extreme, even for his biggest money supporters. So, yeah, I mean, politics is full of, you know, for every Barack Obama, you know, these great success stories, you're going to have 10 Ron DeSantis's, people who thought, you know, they had the magic pixie dust, and it turns out they're just human like everybody else.
What a great conversation. Larry Kamer, who lives right here in the Napa Valley but works all over the country and internationally on all kinds of fascinating issues and topics. It's been a long time since we talked. Thank you so much for doing the pod.
I really appreciate the invite. It was such a pleasure to hear from you. And let's do it again.
This Barry Pod episode recorded on November 14th, 2023.
You're listening to the Barry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning.
On 3, thevine.com.